Well, good afternoon, everyone. And since you've all fallen so beautifully silent, it obviously means that I should begin. Welcome to all of you, and of course to our speakers this afternoon, to this important event in the LSE on our common interest supporting Africa's resurgence. Now, as you know, the Commission for Africa was established by the British government in February 2004 to generate new ideas and action for a strong and prosperous Africa. And the report was produced in March 2005, and launched simultaneously in Addis Ababa, in London, and in New York. And this year, we'll see the coincidence of the United Kingdom's chairmanship of both the G8 and in the second half of the year of the European Union. And Africa will be high on the agenda for the government of the United Kingdom throughout that period. Now, before I introduce the speakers, I should just say that the format of the afternoon will be our speakers speaking for about 20 minutes each. Then I will initiate some discussion between them, and then we will open up the floor for discussion by all of you. So please get your questions ready now and start thinking about the really important and difficult questions you're going to ask. One of the things that the report for the Commission for Africa does is to set a challenge which is awesome in its scale and startling in its clarity. And that is that, can we make poverty a thing of the past? Can we halve extreme poverty by the year 2015? Now, the question is, this has never been done. Can we do it now? Is this merely hubris for all of us in our time? Is it perhaps worse than that, simply empty rhetoric? And what we're going to talk about this afternoon is how what the Commission has done and is going to go on to do is very different from all the early initiatives that have been taken. How the things that the Commission has proposed are not only practicable, but doable, realizable for us here and now. And so I would like to begin by introducing our speakers. Sitting closest to me is Nicholas Stern, who is the Director of Policy at the Commission for Africa and Second Permanent Secretary at the Treasury, as well as Head of the Government Economic Service. We know Nick very well here at the LSE, where he was a professor for a very long time, and chairman of STICCID from 1987 to 1983. And I'm very pleased to say that he's still a visiting professor at the LSE, and we try as much as possible to keep our hooks into him and not let him float too far away from us. And I'd also like then, on the far side, to introduce Tijani Tiam, who is a commissioner for the Commission for Africa. Since November 2002, Tijani's been Group Strategy and Development Director for Aviva PLC. As you all know, Aviva is the seventh largest insurance company in the world and is certainly the largest British insurance company. And he and I have just been talking about how that goal was realized in the few moments before we came in. Tijani is also the co-chair with Ernesto Zedillo, former president of Mexico, of an international task force on global public goods. And this task force is financed by France, Sweden, Germany, and the United Kingdom. And its conclusions will come later in the year. So before I ask Nick to speak, could you please join me in welcoming our speakers this afternoon?
Thanks very much, Henrietta. It's lovely to be back here, but I think it's the first time in any introduction I've ever had, notwithstanding the contrariness of the LSE, that the suggestion is made that you're about to get empty rhetoric. but we'll come back to that when you've heard it. Also, I do appreciate that this is right before exams, and I really we really value your coming here, those of you who have got exams. I have had a word with the examiners in a number of faculties, and they've promised to include questions on the commission for Africa. My task is to tell you as fast as I can what the commission did and what the conclusions were. And Tidjane Thiam, who, as Henrietta said, is a commissioner, will follow from there and ask, well, what kind of reactions might we expect? Where do we take it? Where do we take it from here? But I want to recognize the extraordinary contribution that the 17 commissioners have made. They were asked by the Prime Minister Tony Blair, the then Prime Minister Tony Blair, to participate in this endeavor. That was at the beginning of last year. And they worked very hard and very effectively, and the report was produced and published on March the 11th. It's a big document. They'll be selling it outside for a very modest sum. I encourage you to acquire it, but don't drop it anywhere near your feet. It is very heavy. But we tried to do it as seriously as we could. We did it in a very consultative way, talking to people in a structured manner, all over Africa and outside Africa. So much of last year was spent on consultation, and that we took very seriously indeed. The commissioners themselves are 17 in number, 9 more than half from Africa. So it was very international, and it was a majority Africans on the commission. We had one president, 2 prime ministers, 3 finance ministers, 1 ex-head of the IMF, and 1 rock star. So they were a pretty mixed group. Actually, I got very fond of all of them. I had 17 bosses for a long time, but it was one of the most exhausting assignments that I've ever taken on. I was actually playing basketball at roughly the same height as Tidjane Thiam at the beginning, but I've lost about a foot over the course of this last year. But given the differences, and differences in perspective, differences in background, it's remarkable, I think, how closely the commissioners came together. One thing that they came together on very early, and I think it made a big difference to everything that came later on, was that this was about partnership. Now, that's easy to say and pretty obvious, partnership between Africa and the broader international community. But it was the nature of the partnership that was important. This was a partnership based on common humanity, solidarity, and mutual respect. That is, again, that trips off the tongue fairly easily, but it's fundamental that we're clear on that. Common humanity, solidarity, and mutual respect. It means sharing goals and working together for a common goal. That's very different from a partnership based on narrow contract or conditionality. So the implications of that view of partnership are very important, because what matters then is how different people behave within that partnership, and in particular, the importance of the international community getting behind what Africa is doing. So that was the commissioner, that was the commission and its structure, the way in which we worked in this consultative way, and the partnership, the spirit of partnership that ran through the whole story. Now, the work of the commission was essentially based on an analysis of what the challenges facing Africa have been and why it is that Africa has done so badly over these last 3 decades. Three or four decades ago, the income per capita in Africa was twice that of East Asia and South Asia, twice. When Mirau wrote his long, boring book, Asian Drama, he was focusing on the challenge, as the title says, of Asia. Everybody thought of the teeming herds, the social problems, the difficulty in motivating people, all kinds of things which sound very odd today about Asia. But it wasn't about Africa. The crisis of world poverty is now in Africa. And that was why the commission was focusing right there. Now, there are a number of reasons for having the commission now. The poverty of Africa and how that's come about in the last 30 years or so, of course, is a very powerful argument. But there are deeper arguments than that. But let me start with about why now. But let me start with one or two sort of anniversaries, because they mattered a little bit. This was the 20th anniversary of Live Aid. July the 13th, 1985, was Live Aid. So July the 13th this year is the 20th anniversary of Live Aid. We know, of course, that Bob Geldof was very powerfully involved in that, and Bob thought he would persuade the G8 presidents to meet the day after the 20th anniversary of Live Aid, but somebody drew it to Bob's attention that G8 presidents and their calendars were shaped by more than just the anniversary of the 20th anniversary of Live Aid. But it will be the G8 summit, July the 6th to the 8th, will be just before the 20th anniversary of Live Aid. There are other anniversaries, of course. It's the 60th anniversary of the birth of Bob Marley and the 70th anniversary of the birth of Elvis Presley. But they didn't weigh heavily, I'm sure, in the Prime Minister in looking for the timing of the Commission. It's the 25th anniversary of the Brent Report. So a number of anniversaries, but they're minor. More important, as Henrietta said, was that this is the G8, the year of two G8 presidencies. The two presidencies of the UK, first G8 throughout the whole of 2005, and of the EU in the second half. And so this is an opportunity, a platform, as it were, to push for strong support for Africa. But the most fundamental reason for why now is change in Africa. Africa now is not the same as Africa 15 years ago. If you look at democracy in Africa, with all its faults and all its partialness, you have seen two-thirds of the countries of Africa with elections in the last 5 years or so. Most of the governance indicators, if you look, for example, at the Global Monitoring Report of the World Bank or the Governance Report of the Economic Commission for Africa, most indices of governance in Africa have been improving quite strongly over the last 10 or 15 years. Still way below other regions of the world, but quality of governance increasing at least as fast as other regions of the world. Africa is changing. Now, that is not to gloss over or minimize the deep problems of governance, of conflict, and so on. But it's simply to say that deep as those problems are, Africa is facing up to them, taking them on, and those problems of governance and peace and security much less than they were 15 years ago. There's something to get behind. Africa is taking its destiny in its own hands. The outcome of those improvements in governance and peace and security are now clearly visible in the economic policy and economic growth. Over the last decade, not just 1 year, 16 African countries have grown at 4% or more. Inflation 10 or 15 years ago, around 50% per annum in Africa. It's now in single figures on average. So there's been real change. So none of this, let me emphasize, is to minimize the problems, but Africa is acting and is acting strongly to change its destiny. It's partial and it's fragile, but it's real. And that's very important and key in the view of the Commission to the timing of the whole thing. Now, I haven't got the time to go into detail on the analysis on which the recommendations are based, but just let me highlight two key parts of that analysis. We're asking ourselves the question, East and South Asia have grown like mad in the last 20, 25 years, but Africa has not. Why? Well, the key reasons, and I'm doing this in very much in headline form, but we go into it in some depth in the report, are governance and geography. Now, in Africa, both governance and geography have very powerful historical aspects to them. But the governance of Africa, by the standards of the rest of the world, has been weak over the last 30 years. That's brought with it, of course, an extreme form of conflict. And conflict, of course, is devastating for development. So first, and I think most of us would put this first, is the story of governance and peace and security. Now, Africa is starting to take those on, as we said. The African Union, for example, now has a policy of non-indifference, where the old OAU had a policy of non-interference, fundamental change. The new Partnership for Africa's Development has put governance at the center of the stage and is looking for one country to help the other country in improving its governance, and indeed commenting and analysing the problems of neighbours' governance. So these are major initiatives which are taking place at the continental level in Africa. But we do have to recognise, of course, that governance is homemade, and Africa has recognised that very clearly and is doing its best at the pan-continental level and in many countries, far from all, but in many countries doing its best to change. So there's really something to get behind, but we have to recognise the governance as the legacy and at the root cause of the story, and governance is in large measure made at home, even though there are lots of things that external forces can do to disrupt it. It's in large measure made at home. We'll come back to the policy measures in just a moment. The legacy, of course, on governance left by the colonial powers in Africa was much, much weaker than, for example, in India. Similarly, if you look at the geography of Africa, it's tough, and it's made tougher by it being in sub-Saharan Africa, 48 countries. And we know that political borders quickly become economic barriers. Try taking a truck across an African border. You'll be a lot less in it after you've driven 100 yards from one side of the border to another, and it'll take you days to cross. So political borders become economic barriers. So as it were, in this example I gave, the economic barrier is not just a physical geographical barrier, it's sort of a governance geographical barrier to do with borders in the case of that example. So the fragmentation of Africa left a difficult geography. But if you look at the infrastructure of Africa, if you look at African railways, they go largely from points of natural resource extraction to the nearest port convenient for Europe. If you look at the railways of India, they join up India. It's a very different structure, and again, largely historically inherited. So governance and geography as the fundamental causes, strong historical of Africa's difficulties, strong historical elements in both of those. And that analysis essentially shapes the recommendations that we make. So let me go very rapidly through the six broad areas where we make recommendations, and then I'll hand over to Tijan. Now, we start off with governance. That's absolutely appropriate. Governance and peace and security are the first two action-oriented chapters in the report. They are the foundations of everything else. You can't expect people to invest in for growth and economic activity more generally in an atmosphere where the governance is bad and peace and security are fragile. So we start with governance and peace and security. Of course, health services and education services won't work where governance, where there's conflict or governance is very weak. So those are the foundations, that's where we start. Now, there's lots you can do to improve governance and peace and security. I'll have a little more to say about governance because Tijan Tiam was one of the two commissioners who was focusing directly on issues of peace and security. But on governance, we looked at the story of governance essentially in two ways, in terms of capacity and accountability. What could the international community do to help support Africa's efforts to improve governance and accountability? Sorry, improve governance through the support for capacity and accountability. So capacity first. There's strong emphasis here on investing in education right through the system. I'll come back to that in a moment. But from the point of view of governance capacity, investing in higher education, including in science and technology. Africa's universities in the 1960s, in many cases, were actually quite strong. Some people in the room, indeed, were involved in Africa's universities at that period. They were pretty strong. They've deteriorated enormously in the last 30 years or so. So strong investment in Africa's systems of higher education. Of course, if you want to keep your skilled people, you must also improve governance more generally, investment climate more generally, so that they have some incentive to use their skills in an environment which they find rewarding and productive. So that's part of the story on capacity. There are other parts of the story in terms of investing in civil service reform and so on. On accountability, again, there's a great deal that the outside world can do to help a lot on accountability. One thing, for example, is to put pressure on natural resource companies to publish what they pay. And we say quite a lot in the report on the extractive industries transparency initiative. A lot of corruption and indeed conflict is financed through natural resource rents. So that's a big story of the improving accountability. But again, there's lots that outside people can do. With stronger institutions of higher education, you have places that can hold governments to account. One of the functions of the LSE is to give the government a hard time in the UK, and it does that with enthusiasm and skill. That is what partly what universities are for. So there's lots of ways in which we can work to support the improvement of accountability. Another way we can do it is through the kind of aid that we give. A tremendous amount of aid involves very heavy accountability to a whole string of different aid givers. So governments spend all their time writing reports to outside aid givers, and that actually diverts attention from accountability to their own people. So there are lots of ways in which, by supporting different kinds of activities like universities, changing behaviour in the private sector through publish what you pay, in the public sector through the kinds of ways we give aid. There's lots one can do to improve, to work to help Africa improve accountability. So that's governance. Peace and security, get behind the African Union and all it's trying to do. I won't develop that because Tijan may have a little more to say, but I already drew the sharp distinction between the African Union and its predecessor, the OAU, and getting behind the efforts of the African Union, a very important part of attacking the problems of peace and security. Investing in development itself is a key way of attacking peace and security. The rich world spends about $900 to $1,000 billion dollars on defense. It spends around $50 billion, well, a bit more than that now, $60, $65, $70 billion on aid. So $65, $70 billion on aid versus $900 to $1,000 billion on defense, actually investing in development is a very powerful contribution to investing in peace. So I won't develop the peace and security story anymore. We then turn from those basic foundations to two broad kinds of investment. Investment in people and investment in growth. Investment in people, and that accounts for around half of the resources that we recommend, is obviously particularly concerned with education and with health. Two big messages there. First, that unless we move to support the development of systems of health and systems of education, other kinds of interventions are going to be fatally weakened. You can parachute as many antiretrovirals into Africa or anywhere else as you like. If the health systems don't work, you won't have much effect. So it's very important that the various initiatives that come on health and education work to support and strengthen the functioning of systems in Africa and are not diversionary or deal or lead to further fragmentation. So invest strongly in building health systems that work and in which health professionals can function effectively. Second is to come up and meet the promises of the Millennium Development Goals and the funding that is required to do those for health and for education. We have got reasonable estimates of what it's going to cost to make a difference. It's a tough challenge, but we can at least accelerate strongly towards the Millennium Development Goals. So fulfill on those commitments. So build the systems, fulfill on the commitments for health and education. And a big slice of the monies recommended for health are, of course, on combating the terrible tragedy of HIV/AIDS in Africa. Moving on to the story of growth and participation in growth. We lay great emphasis on improving governance and the investment climate. The investment climate in Africa, in terms of the difficulties of actually working in business in Africa, the investment climate is, in Africa, a lot weaker than elsewhere. Working to improve governance will make a big difference. And working, public and private sector working in partnership will make a big difference. The behavior of foreign direct investors can make a big difference to the overall investment climate. But secondly is the challenge of infrastructure. Africa currently invests around 10 or 12 billion a year in infrastructure. It has to be if Africa is to achieve anything like the 7% growth rate that's necessary. I'll come back to that number in a moment. It has to be at least double that, perhaps triple. So a big major investment in Africa's infrastructure is a big part of the story. Now, the development institutions of the world, I think, have done damage to the whole story of infrastructure by pretending through much of the 90s that somehow that was going to be financed through the private sector. That was quite simply a mistake in which a number of development institutions, including the World Bank and DFID and others, participated. If you look at the numbers, something like 20% in Africa of infrastructure is financed by the private sector, and nearly all of that is telecoms. That's not so wildly different from finance for infrastructure elsewhere in the world. Average figures in other continents might be 75% public and 25% private finance. So to pretend that suddenly the problems of infrastructure can be solved by private finance is a fraud, and it's a mistake, and that's something which we draw attention to very strongly. Private sector can and should build the roads and build the bridges, but that's not the same as financing the roads and financing the bridges. So what I'm talking about here is the finance side. So a very strong emphasis on infrastructure. We go on to talk a lot about trade. I won't develop it at great length here, but Africa's share of world trade has dropped over the last 20, 25 years from something like 6% to something under 2%. Now, disgraceful though the barriers are to trade from poor countries, that drop from around 6% to less than 2% in 20, 25 years was not from the barriers that Africa faces. Asia faced the same or bigger barriers. It has to do in large measure with the capacity to trade. Infrastructure story is big there, but help also in diversifying into new products is part of the story as well. So first and foremost, we emphasize the capacity to trade. That being said, of course, the barriers which Africa and other developing countries face are simply disgraceful. The report says, and it's language I've used elsewhere, that those barriers are politically antiquated, economically illiterate, environmentally destructive, and ethically indefensible. Apart from that, they're all right. And the barrier question is very clear, and we're very clear ourselves on that story. But we put first Africa's capacity to trade, and I think that's right. That's right where the emphasis should be. Now, when we've done all that, we come up with quite big numbers on what all this will cost. So we did bottom up first. But then we went top down. We asked ourselves the question, and it's an important question, can Africa absorb the kind of flows that we're talking about? So we went very carefully into that question, looking at all the evidence we could find, project level, program level, country level, cross-country regression analysis, and so on, to try to understand that question as best we could. Now, the capacity to absorb aid depends on three things, broadly speaking. It depends on governance institutions' policy first in the country itself. It depends on how the aid is allocated across countries. And third, it depends on the quality of the aid in terms of its predictability, conditionality, harmonization with other aid givers, elements of accountability, the burdens of accountability, and so on. So it depends broadly on those three things. And if you look at the evidence, there is reasonably encouraging evidence of improvements on all those three areas that determine the productivity of aid or determine the absorptive capacity. But it's also true that there's a very long way to go. But essentially, the conclusion that we come to is that Africa could absorb an extra $25 billion of aid per annum by 2010. Current aid to Africa is around $25 billion per annum, and that, we argue, can and should increase by an extra $25 billion per annum by 2010. We also argue that, subject to experience there, depending on how well that has gone, how well those three factors that I'm describing, which shape the productivity of aid, how well those three factors move ahead, then there should be a further increase of $25 billion per annum between 2010 and 2015. So it's a very major increase in aid that we're recommending. We don't do it lightly. We do it in a way on the basis of bottom-up analysis and of an analysis of absorptive capacity. But it's a strong increase in aid that's necessary if Africa is to reach the 7% growth rate, which we argue is necessary, and to make strong progress towards the Millennium Development Goals. Let me say one or two words about the 7% growth rate. Africa is becoming more and more marginalized in terms of income from the rest of the world. Asia is growing above 7%, and it's got a population growth rate which is less than Africa's. If Africa is to have any chance of becoming arresting that marginalization, then an increase in growth rates to something like 7% will be necessary. It's ambitious, but some parts of Africa have achieved those growth rates for extended periods. We know it's possible from Africa itself. We know it's possible from East and now South Asia. So we argue that those sites should be raised reasonably high from that point of view. Those of you who like doing your mental arithmetic will also know that 7% growth rates double in a decade, and people whose eyes glaze over at the difference between 6.5% and 7.5% usually are able to understand pretty clearly that the objective is to double income in Africa over a decade. So it's easy to communicate. That's one of the attractiveness of the 7% number. But that's a minor argument, not a major argument. The major arguments have to do with marginalization from the rest of the world and what's necessary to give any chance of a strong acceleration towards meeting the Millennium Development Goals. So that, very broadly speaking, is the set of recommendations. We have quite a lot of recommendations on implementation. Perhaps Tijan may say a word or two about that. But I've tried to take you from the story of the conception at the beginning of the Commission for Africa, its composition, why now, its method of work, the logic of its analysis, and where its conclusions go. So let me hand over to one of my 17 bosses, Tijan Thiam. Thank you.
Nick, thank you very much indeed for that very comprehensive overview in a short time. Much appreciated. And now, if I could just ask Tijan to give his presentation.
Thank you. Thank you, Henrietta. Good afternoon. Nick has had 17 buses for about a year, and I think he has survived that very well and served us very well. Being a member of a commission has been an interesting experience. I guess I should say a few words about the way it all started for me. Someone called me and said, you know, a commission for Africa is being set up, and actually the Prime Minister would like you to join the commission. And it's the kind of sentences that can sound ominous sometimes, because your first reaction is, you know, what have I done? You know, why? And I received a letter confirming that, and then I got into an interesting debate, I guess, with myself, saying, should I do this? What for? I think I'm like you. I think, well, all the solutions are known. If these people were serious about this, they would have done something a long time ago. I mean, a lot of things you're thinking, you know, I was thinking too. And I said, well, why don't I try to meet a number of people involved? And I talked to a few people. And I started feeling that, well, maybe there was an opportunity here to do something slightly different. And I must say that when I look back today, I don't regret the choice I've made of joining, because I think, I mean, you'll read the report or you've read it, you'll have your own view on it, but I do believe that the report is quite hard-hitting in some parts of it. I mean, we've addressed some of the tough issues for Africans and for developed countries, and I hope, and I'll come back to that, later, that there is the beginning of a political will to really address what is a tragic situation for our continent today. And I went in with a few, views of which I feel strongly about. I mean, one is really that Africans can solve their own problems. They don't need people to solve their problems in their place. They may need aid, they may need assistance, they may need help, but they can solve their own problems. And I was adamant on this throughout the process, and I think it's reflected in the paper that's been produced. Because, you see, I've spent a number of years in Africa before being working for a UK insurance group, and I was in government in the Ivory Coast. And I must say that when you deal with the donors and people coming from the outside to help you, you're dealing with a wide spectrum of profiles and beliefs. And I was always surprised when I ran into people who really thought that Africans were just quite helpless and just needed, you know, to be patronized and told what to do. And those views, I'm sorry, even among well-meaning people, are still very, very prevalent. As I've said, sometimes it's our economies that are underdeveloped, not our brains. So it's very important to keep that in mind and approach Africa and its problems from that perspective. The second thing I was very keen on is really that there is no single model. Every time I sat across a World Bank official telling me, well, the right way to do this is the following, I would always just remind him or her that the five largest economies in the world are the US, Germany, Japan, the UK or France, depending on the years. And you couldn't imagine five more different models in terms of the role of the state, in terms of the institutional framework, in terms of the culture and the history. So I'm always uncomfortable when people come to me in Africa and tell me, well, this is the way you should do things. And I've always claimed that there is no one-size-fits-all, there is no one model, and it is very important to be effective in Africa to recognize the complexity of the situations and the diversity of the situations. And I think the report took that on board too. Another thing that seemed important for me was to really deal seriously with the governance and peace and security issues, and that's why I personally focused on peace and security, because that's not my area of competence, even, I could say. But my experience working more on the private sector and financial and economic side has been that that is absolutely crucial, and that is often overlooked in the traditional thinking and the traditional work on development. If people cannot move from point A to point B safely or without telling their last wills to their family, you know, you have a problem. It's very hard to get any kind of development. And I think the report is addressing that too. So where are we now? I thought the choice of date for this event was interesting. I think May 9th, when I was told about it, I said, well, it's after the election. Hopefully we'll have a clearer idea of what's forward, and I think that's the case now. The British election is behind us. The government can focus on Gleneagles, on the G8 summit, and on achieving some actual change after all this analytical work. And I think actually we're in good shape to do that. But I think it's also a collective responsibility. We've often been asked, well, you've done this work, what's going to happen now? And I think part of the answer depends on what we all do. I mean, us here and you in this room individually, because at the end of the day, when I was in government, I used to talk a lot about the agricultural subsidies and the common agricultural policy and asking for the elimination of subsidies and so on and so forth. And I remember one EU minister, I won't say which country he's from, I'm sure you'll guess, but who was a big beneficiary of a common agricultural policy, told me, look, you know, Mr. Cham, you know, I think he was tired after my 10th, the 10th time that I explained to him exactly the same thing over and over again. I said, no, you know what, actually, I'm going to make a confession. I completely agree with you, but, you know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Nothing is going to change, because as long as the nature of a political system in our country is what it is, the countryside will be overly represented in the political system, and, you know, that's the nature of things. There's nothing I can do about it. Tough luck. So I think that's when I had to wake up and really accept that at the end of the day, it's all about political will. It's all about what happens politically inside the developed countries. That's why this notion of advocacy and using the media and working with the media to reach public opinion is very important. What I'm going to say may be not politically correct, but the tsunami was very interesting for me, because what it confirmed is really that if people get the right information, they will make the right decisions and have the right behavior. I'm sorry, but a lot of Westerners were caught in that catastrophe. So it got a disproportionate coverage. You know, things like that happen all the time in the third world. They're not covered. Because if you take a camera to wherever, Côte d'Ivoire, Sierra Leone, Burkina Faso, and show it on TV, you'll get 1% viewership. You know, and the viewership drives everything. That made good TV, got a lot of time on TV, and we all know the result. We know how much money was raised. So I think this issue of being able to connect with people and make them truly aware of what really is going on, of the consequences of their inaction or their excessive action for millions of people is really critical. And I must say Africa has been... people talk about a lot of market failures about Africa, but communication, information is one area where Africa has suffered a lot. I always tell people to go to Africa because that is simply the most misrepresented area in the world. You know, so anyway, you can only gain from going there and being exposed and understanding what's going on. So a big part of what we have to do is really continue to preach, to communicate, to talk about the issues, talk about the what's going on in Africa, talk about the fact that actually something can be done about that reality so that we finally get enough support to get the leaders and the politicians to make the right choice and have the right behavior. I think a number of countries are moving in the right direction. The UK and France have already announced significant increases in their aid flows. Germany has made some public statements. Canada has made some public statements as well. The U.S. is an interesting case. Tuesday, next week, I'll be in front of the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee talking about the commission with another commissioner. And I think we have a whole series of actions planned vis-à-vis the U.S. using all the relevant channels, whether the churches or the government or the media, to get that message across and get people to fundamentally write to their congressmen, because that's what will make things happen in the U.S. No one country will do everything. I think there are a lot of recommendations in the report. Countries, because of their history and their individual characteristics, have strengths in various areas. I mean, if you take a country like Japan, in my country, there are millions, literally millions of people who have access to safe water thanks to the programs that Japan did in that field, or to primary education. So each country has its area of specialization and can take the lead on any given area. But I think it's very important to win the battle of public opinion, if I can say so, and really be able to kill forever a number of ideas that have been very, very detrimental. All African leaders are corrupt. Everything ends up in war anyway. They cannot get their act together. If I go further, they're lazy. Why put money there? You know, it's no use, and so on and so forth. I think there is really a need to take those things, not deny them, because anyway, you're talking to people, some of them have that in the back of their head anyway. So I think it's better to address these issues and supply the evidence that proves that that's not true. I mean, Africans, there are many, many, many entrepreneurs in Africa. I mean, if you go to New York today, when it rains, if you turn around, you're going to see the Mourid salespeople from Senegal at every street corner selling you umbrellas, okay? And they had to win that space with their fists. I mean, they fought the mafia and they fought the gangs that were controlling that business. So don't let anybody tell me that Africans are not entrepreneurial or are not driven. That's just not true. There's so much evidence to the contrary. But the issue is really about freeing the energies, giving people opportunities and giving them the means to seize those opportunities. So I think the whole, I don't know if that's the right expression in English, but the Afro-pessimism, I mean, the kind of doom and gloom picture has to be fought. When people say, well, Africa has done terribly, okay, fine. If I take my country, when France left in 1960, the school enrollment rate was 9%. Okay, and every time a donor would tell me, well, you know, Mr. Thiam, you only have 75% school enrollment rate, you know, it always sounded a little bit funny, okay? Because moving from 9% to 75% when the population has quadrupled, I would not exactly characterize as a massive failure. You know, it's just really the ability to put things in perspective and really judge Africans based on their actual achievements and not on what someone in an ideal world thinks they should have done. And I would claim that actually under the circumstances and with the constraints, weighing on African economies. A lot of countries have done very well, and I challenge anybody to do better. This is an anecdote, but I was able to convince one of the people in the French government who was looking after the whole of West Africa to come and spend a year in the Ministry of Transport in the Ivory Coast. I was very proud of that because he came to see me after 6 months, and I've rarely seen anybody more embarrassed. He didn't even know where to start. You know. And he explained to me that he had been trying to get a decree adopted for the last 6 months, and that's all he'd done. You know. And he hadn't even succeeded with all his talent and all his good education and all his good ideas. So I think understanding that it's not just a question of laziness or lack of intelligence, that the obstacles are much more significant than that, there is no level playing field today. That's a notion I think that was central in the report also, trying to get a more level playing field for Africa, trying to stop people dumping agricultural surpluses at subsidized prices on the African markets. I mean, there are many, many things that the West must do, not selling weapons to warlords. There are many, many things that the developed countries must do, which is, for me, almost a precautionary logic of doing no harm. If they cannot positively help, they have at least to stop their most damaging behaviors. So I think the report was very exhaustive. It's impossible to do it justice here. I think Nick did a very good job in kind of summarizing the recommendations. This is a time for action. It will not be easy. I think it's going to take many battles. I think 2005 is a critical moment, and it would be a tragedy if really, with a conjunction of events and of goodwill that have been mobilized, we couldn't achieve a significant change in the way Africa is seen in the media today and in the way the rest of the world interacts with Africa. So my purpose today is really, again, to encourage you all to act. I believe if you're in this room today, it's because you have an interest. I'm aware of the exams. My student days are not that far away. But I think many of you have an interest, want to do something. It can only help. I think everybody will be useful in that battle. I know that Bob Geldof is working to organize things leading up to the Glen Eagles Summit. But we have to create a situation where it becomes more and more uncomfortable for a number of people to do nothing about situations that are truly tragic. So thank you for your attention.
All right, Tijan, thank you for giving a very cogent account of why we need to act and act now. Perhaps I could sort of open up discussion a little by asking a couple of questions that have been on my mind, having listened to our speakers this afternoon. And perhaps, Nick, I could start with you. 7% growth is very ambitious. That takes Africa up to what India has achieved and not too far behind China. And the one thing that you didn't talk about this afternoon, but I know you have views on, is much of this growth will have to be related in some way or other to agricultural incomes. And I wondered if you could say something about what needs to be done for agriculture, which is the major source of people's livelihood.
Thanks. Thanks very much, Henrietta. Is this microphone working? Yeah, thanks. There's one thing I meant to say at the beginning, is that we're doubly grateful for any of you who may have shown up on February the 17th when this lecture was first advertised. February the 17th was a casualty of the election. When it became clear what the date of the election was going to be, the date of publication of the report came forward. And that meant that February the 17th, which we thought would be nicely positioned between a first draft and a second draft of the report so that discussions could take place on the basis of a genuinely open position. It turned out that because of the accelerated timetable, February the 17th was after the date at which the second and close to final draft had already been written, and we felt that in those circumstances it would not be honest to have the meeting here at that time. So it wasn't a near-death experience that I suffered in a direct and immediate way. It was a long, drawn-out process of 1,000 cuts of writing the report. But that issue of the cancellation had to do with the timing of the election and the accelerated program of the report. So my deep apologies to those of you who were put out by the cancellation on February the 17th. Now, the story of the 7% growth rate, it's ambitious relative to Africa as a whole. There's no doubt about that. But I don't think it's ambitious from the point of view of the goals for development that the world has set and where Africa's fallen so far behind. I don't think it's ambitious relative to East Asia and South Asia. Everybody was telling us in the 60s there are all these fundamental reasons why East Asia and South Asia would never grow very quickly. And the ensuing decades proved those wrong. So in terms of the wasted decades that we've seen, and in terms of the goals that have been set, and in terms of what's possible, as demonstrated by East and South Asia, and indeed by significant parts of Africa itself, I don't think that it's right to see those as ambitious. I think it's the minimum that's necessary to arrest the further and dangerous marginalization of Africa in income terms from the rest of the world. Now, what about agriculture? Agriculture in Africa has suffered particularly badly. Is that the ice cream?
Yeah.
He didn't tell me about the ice cream.
No, he's going to sing, I think.
Okay. If you look at output per acre in Africa, it's been broadly unchanged over 30 years or so. Output per acre, at a time when population over three or four decades has quadrupled. When I first worked on agriculture in Africa, it was 1969, I worked on tea in Kenya. The population of Kenya at that time was 8 million people. It's now about 32. And just as Tijan was saying about the quadrupling of the population of Cote d'Ivoire, an output per acre has stayed roughly the same. It's not surprising that you've seen such big rises in African poverty, and not surprising that Africa is seeing a quite extraordinarily rapid urbanization. Indeed, an urbanization that's faster than anywhere than we've seen anywhere in the world in economic history. It's just quite extraordinary. But given the static nature of output per acre in agriculture and the movement of population, it's hardly surprising. Now, the challenge then for growth has to come in large measure in agriculture. Something like 4% of arable land in Africa is irrigated, 4%. In South Asia, it's around 40. So one part of the story, you can't go from 4 to 40% very quickly, but you can move much more strongly than has happened in the past, and that's a big part of the recommendations. And if you look at the history of the Green Revolution, and that's I and others sat and worked on the Green Revolution in India in the 70s and 80s, a big part of that story was irrigation. So irrigation infrastructure of and many different kinds of that, from bigger projects and perhaps even more important sort of micro projects, water harvesting and so on. A big part of the story of growth in agriculture in Africa will come from irrigation. A big part of the story will come from basic transport infrastructure. Around 30% of produce in Africa, on average, is lost after harvest. A lot of that has to do with storage and transportation to markets, the functioning of markets. So that's another big area where substantial investment could make a tremendous difference. Agricultural extension is very weak in Africa, and again, that played quite a big part in the Green Revolution stories in South Asia. And agricultural extension depends in large measure on the functioning of local universities. When Norman Borlaug and his crew came up with the improved varieties of maize and wheat in Mexico in the 50s and 60s, that stuff was quickly translated through local universities in South Asia and elsewhere into varieties that were suitable for those regions. So a tremendous amount of work, I think, can come in that area too. So And of course, opening up the barriers in rich countries is a big part of the story as well. So accelerating growth in agriculture in Africa is going to have to come from action across a broad range. It's not cheap, but it's urgent. We try to cost it as best we can and come up with specific recommendations.
Thank you, Nick. Dejan, I wanted to, talking about accelerating growth, and every sector has its role to play. And I took on very much on board your point about diversity of models, but I wondered if you had a little bit more to say about what kind of models for public-private partnership, because this is a terrifically difficult area. And in fact, we might learn something for the UK, because we have our own problems with public-private partnerships here at the moment. But I would like to ask you if you'd have a bit more to say about that.
All right. Thank you. I think it's an important topic, and it raises the issue of the role of the private sector in general. I mean, I did make a statement about the diversity of situations and of models, but that being said, I'm not a believer in absolute extreme relativism. I mean, there are a few sound principles I think that everybody must adhere to, and I would claim that the development of the private sector is one of those. Actually, I think it's very closely linked to the agricultural question, because factually, most of the private sector in Africa is the small farmers who are looking after their land and producing. So a very important role for the private sector. One thing I'd like to say there also is really emphasize very much the domestic private sector, because I think that there is almost a cultural bias among many African leaders towards the international private sector. And I emphasize the importance of having homegrown and, I mean, indigenous companies and that are able to thrive and do well, if only because that reduces the incentive to join the government in order to make money, if you can make money in the private sector. So that's a very important thing if we're ever to have any kind of development. And the quality of the dialogue with the private sector is also something that is extremely important, and making sure that governments that are often culturally the heirs of basically the colonial tradition open up to their private sector and truly listen to it. This is something I've said often to African leaders in government. I mean, the private sector today, one of the first things we would look at if we were supposed to go in a new country is how are the domestic players treated by the government? Because as an international player, you don't believe that you can succeed in a place where there are no homegrown entrepreneurs or no homegrown private sector. Now, on public-private partnerships, I completely support what Nick said about infrastructure and the need to be sensible in terms of determining what should be done, well, financed first and done by the public and by the private sector. And I think that the donors have done a lot of damage. I've been very happy to hear the UK government, how can I say this, congratulate the Kenyan government on the elimination of school fees and the fact that 1 million children suddenly went to school. I just happened, as a former African government official, to have negotiated education programs with the World Bank and the IMF, and that was a conditionality, the school fees. You know, and we could argue as much as we wanted, we weren't listened to, which brings us back to an issue I haven't discussed, but maybe we'll have a chance in the questions and answers to come back to, but the role of the international financial institutions in all this and a certain lack of political accountability, and the weak position that governments have vis-à-vis them. So I think the private sector can do a lot in many fundamental sectors. I mean, we're seeing it in telecommunications today, with the revolution in Africa. I think we've seen it in energy too. A number of countries have now engaged in energy projects with the private sector, where the private sector can be very, very, very useful. And if we look at Asia, I mean, my company has created 4,000 jobs. I mean, I was in Bangalore about 6 weeks ago. We have 4,000 employees in India. That was done in 2 years. Frankly, when I go to India and I sit in our call centers and I look at what's going on, there are very little reasons why many, many African countries, not all of them, but why a select few couldn't do the same thing and engage in the same opportunities, which are, I think, beneficial for everybody. So it's really about creating the conditions for the private sector to develop, because when you have a population that's growing at 4% per annum, if you don't give jobs to young people, they'll take arms and start, how can I say this, grabbing what they can. So I think this issue of job creation and investment in Africa is very important.
Thank you very much. So I've abused my position as chair by getting my questions in, and that's all because I told you to get ready with your questions. So I hope you're ready now. There are some good roving mics. Yeah, so roving mics everywhere. We'll start in this corner here, I think, this time. We'll take them in batches of three, please. So this gentleman here in the front, and then the gentleman behind you.
Thank you very much. My name is Ludovic Ndoua from Côte d'Ivoire, and Mr. Thiam also is from Côte d'Ivoire, and I'm very happy about it, and I'm very proud. I've been coming here for nearly 8 months, attending public lectures, and we've been discussing topics from human rights issues to development. And I've also been to other public lectures where it was about development and other things. But this particularly is interesting for me because it's related to Africa. And as an African, I think this is the occasion for us to be able to speak out and have our problems solved. I have 3 points to make. The first one is, I really don't know, and I hope I'll have the answer. I don't understand why there is still after 45 years of independence, the French government still have military presence in Africa. This is the first point. As far as I know, there have been many colonial powers. But still, I mean, I don't know. You can tell me if the British government has some military presence in Africa in any of its former colonies. That's the first point. The second point is about private investment. It's about private investment. I've noticed that African countries have been divided according to the former colonial powers, so that there is a monopoly on local economies by former colonial power, and this is very damaging for local economy, and it's also very damaging for governance and democracy, because we've seen that the French militaries have always broken the backbone of fragile democracies which are being implemented in Africa. And it's quite a shame to think and accept it. The third point is about aid to Africa. Did the panel bear in mind when suggesting a solution that not all countries, even developed countries, not all of them have the same level of development? So developing countries all of them are not at the same level of developing stage. There are some which are slightly more developing than those who are still far behind. For example, if when you are helping countries, I know that you won't be helping South Africa as you will be doing for Burkina Faso, or you won't be helping Togo as you will be doing for Cote d'Ivoire, for example. Did you bear that in mind? Yeah. And the last thing is...
That's four, that's cheating. Yeah,
no, I'm sorry. The last thing is, politically, I think France has got too much influence in Africa. Look at, for example, every year there is a conference, France-Africa, a country with a whole continent. How can that be bearable? How can that be acceptable?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So, this gentleman behind, please. And I have to say, you see, I started this problem because I asked two questions. Now you asked four. And now everyone else is only asking one, okay? Yes, please.
Ultimately, it seems to me that the problems in Africa will require political will. What evidence is there? Could you give examples of that political will showing itself so that this resurgence that we are talking about can come about?
Thank you very much. We'll just take two questions here, one, and then we'll answer those four, and then we'll take another block here.
Yeah, a brief question. Civil wars have taken a very heavy toll in Africa. So my question I'd like to ask, what international solution is there to control the prevalence of civil war in many African countries?
Thank you. I noticed from both your lectures that you're very understandably concerned with issues of governance and accountability, economic growth, education, health, and so on. I'm wondering how you see the role of the media in all this, and I'm thinking particularly of the establishment of an effective, independent, indigenous Pan-African media, so a kind of African Al Jazeera, as it were. I wonder if you think that would be a worthwhile step.
Thank you. Great. So, can I ask you, would you both like to respond in any order that you feel like?
Well, I was going to let Nick handle my countryman, but
yes,
since he wants me to, maybe I'll try. Okay, I think maybe I'll just take the question sequentially. There was a question about French military presence in Africa. Frankly, I don't really have an answer on that. I think that's a question for the French to answer. Private investment, I think I may want to give some context, because I suppose I know why you're asking this question. It's because a number of key sectors in the Ivory Coast have been privatized, and there's a big debate there over private monopolies versus public monopolies. And I think fundamentally the answer on that one is really your ability to regulate. That's really the issue. A private monopoly can be appropriately regulated if you have strong capacities and if you're able to actually control what's going on and regulate appropriately. And well, it's debatable if that was done in Côte d'Ivoire or not, but I think that's the answer. Aid to Africa, not all countries have the same level of development. I think that's really a strong theme in the Commission and what it tried to recommend, really recognizing the differences between the countries and the fact that your approach has to be the right one for that country. I think a tough problem there is really this whole issue of the weak states or the failing states. I've never been comfortable with the notion that you should only help the good pupils, because I say it's like a teacher in a classroom who would say that he's going to focus on his good pupils, but forgetting that there is a contagious disease in the classroom and that the good pupils will get it too. And we've seen in West Africa what Sierra Leone and Liberia have done to the stability of the whole region. So I think you need a dual approach where you need, I believe, in positive rewards. I mean, you need to reward good behavior with additional flows and incentives, but you also need to help the weaker countries evolve. Because as someone who comes from our country said once, you should never aspire to be an oasis in the desert, because generally it's the desert that wins. So it's really about applying that logic. And you said, that was more a statement, I think. You said politically France has too much influence in Africa. Well, I can't really comment on that. Would you like to take the next one? Okay, then I'll continue. Problems with you saying, I think you asked about political will. May I just ask you, did you mean in the developing countries in Africa, or did you mean in the developed countries?
Yeah.
Is there a political will in Africa? Yeah, I think there are examples of countries that have evolved positively. I think if you look at Ghana,
that's a country that has overall has had a positive evolution, where you've had a for me, the ultimate test is whether you're able to change majorities without having a civil war, which will bring us back to the point about civil war. And I think that has happened in Ghana peacefully. They've had a peaceful and democratic transition. I think that's important. It's a country that's doing reasonably well. I mean, there are other examples. It's always questionable. You can always find a given aspect that is not so good, but I think a country like Tanzania would claim has evolved positively overall. Probably a country like Mozambique has evolved positively overall. I think a country like Senegal also has shown some positive signs. I mean, you can make a list, but I think I always say, if only people could look at Africa the way they look at any other place. I always claim that we can only benefit from being treated rationally, because I always reminded people that Sarajevo was 2 hours away from Paris, okay? And nobody was saying, because there was a war in Croatia, that Europe is a basket case. I mean, there is an ability to put things in perspective. History is a difficult process all over the planet, and there are crises everywhere, and there are problems, but there are also areas where things are going better. And sir, you were asking about the civil wars and what we're doing about it. I think the Commission is actually quite strong, I think, on that theme. We've emphasized the importance of prevention because we believe that in most of those crises there were warning signals, and people observing the situation knew that there was trouble coming. So we've talked about early warning signals. We've talked about supporting the capability at the AU to intervene and go in and mediate early on. We've talked about African solutions, and I must say, personally, it's a theme I really pushed in the Commission, and I'm actually very happy about the recent evolution. When I see what Mr. Mbeki has done for the Ivory Coast, for instance, I think it's a very good example. When I see what ECOWAS has started doing in Togo, I think I was thrilled. I saw a statement from the Quai d'Orsay saying that, after all, it looks like the Africans are possibly able to solve some of their problems. So I take that as a very encouraging sign, a very encouraging signal. So I think the Commission has also been strong on the Arms Trade Treaty, and I think that's getting more and more support about the small weapons and making sure that their trade is controlled. Because, I mean, there are a lot of people in London or in Paris who know exactly who's buying what, where, through who, and how much they've paid and when. I mean, that's known. Okay? So those things are going on because there's not much public attention on it. When I was talking earlier about the media and awareness and raising awareness, those things can go unhindered because they're not talked about. How come that there are so many weapons in the poorest area in the world? How come? We're talking about transferring aid to Africa. Well, I'm always saying there are some people who are very good, who are mastering all the financial circuits in the world, because they're certainly able to move weapons around and get them to any part of Africa at any point in time. So that issue of the Arms Trade Treaty, I think, is important and is going to get, I think, a lot of support. And finally, we've also talked about the conflict goods and the importance of controlling their trade. I think that's linked also to a question on the media and the Pan-African media. It's often a vicious circle, because if you look at the press in Africa, once you've said that a lot of people are illiterate, that included my own mother, I mean, a lot of people are illiterate. I mean, how much readership is there? So when you start trying to run a newspaper on an economic basis, it just doesn't work. And what I've seen time and time again is that it's actually widespread corruption in the media. I could tell you so many anecdotes. I mean, it's not even funny. There is a market for articles, and everybody knows the market price in each newspaper and how much you have to pay either to have a story written or to stop a story. So you have a very artificial world that has developed, where a lot of newspapers that are not viable are artificial creations that are fed by basically the proceeds of corruption. So I think you need to break out of that. I think personally that the radio is actually a big part of the answer, because that's the way to reach a large part of the population in a way that is commercially viable. And I think there are people who are trying to do that. But it's fundamental, because if you want to get into the virtuous circle of democracy, people have to know what's going on so that they can apply some pressure and some accountability on their leaders. I do not believe in accountability imposed from the outside. I mean, I always run the thought experiment, you know, some people from some other planet come here and find that we're all very primitive, including the US or the UK, and decide that we're going to improve the way we run our own affairs. It's never going to work. You don't achieve sustainable development or democracy by coming from the outside and banging on the table. The way the leaders are kept honest is by their own population. So if their own population doesn't know what's going on, you have something broken there. And you can try to duplicate that with conditionalities and IMF programs and so on and so forth, but it's never going to be very, very effective. So I do believe that the media is at the heart of a problem, the media in Africa, and then also the media outside, because I think, how can I say this? The media as a whole could do a better job in covering Africa and talking about African issues. Nick?
Thank you, Tijan. Tijan has covered most of the points. Let me just say something about political will in rich countries, and I can read you the recommendations on media for from the Commission. The kinds of behavioural changes that we are pressing for, together with the kind of resources that we're asking for in the Commission for Africa report, are not going to come without tremendous pressure from the people in rich countries. The challenge is to make development a real political issue in the rich countries if we're going to get change on that part of the partnership. It's happened at some points. I think the Live Aid of 20 years ago, the debt campaign, particularly around the last G8 summit, which was in Birmingham, tsunami. There are a few occasions in which development has become a really strong political issue in rich countries. The challenge is to make it a sustained political issue in rich countries. Bob Geldof hopes to bring a million of his friends to Glen Eagles. I start to take it seriously when I see my colleagues at the Treasury wondering whether it's the Scottish Executive or the British taxpayer more generally who's going to pay for that. That's a signal that something might happen. So that's one example of real pressure that can be brought to bear. But that's a constant challenge, and I think we all, including NGOs here, need to get still better at doing that. I think extra communications, television in particular, help in doing that, but it's a constant challenge, and I don't think that those who are working on development in rich countries have yet really cracked that one, and the Commission for Africa was intended as a major step along that road. I mean, the Prime Minister could have asked me and one or two colleagues to go away and write a report on the Commission for Africa. It would have been a much quieter year if we'd have done it that way. But he didn't decide to do that. He decided that he was going to set up something which would be a very strong part of a political process leading up to Glen Eagles, and to do something which would essentially challenge the British government. And there's quite a lot here that does challenge the British government, and we're quite strong on the repatriation of assets, for example. Why is it that stolen assets from Africa can be repatriated from Switzerland but not from the UK? There's quite a lot here that will stretch the UK, but the Prime Minister deliberately set it up in a way that would be outside the control of the British government. He wouldn't be so silly as to think he could control Tijan on my left here. He can't control Michel Condesou, who was a French member of the committee, and he certainly can't control Bob Geldof. So he knew what he was doing. It was a risk. He took a risk, and it's still a risky business, because we've raised expectations. We're going up to Glen Eagles with a real attempt to get some movement from the G8. We don't know that that's going to happen, but the challenge is to get people to understand that taking strong action now is a response that Africa now needs, which Africa has now shown can be really productive, and that to do business as usual will mean outcomes as usual, and it will in fact be much more risky for the world than attempting to make a big push and a major response right now. So we've got to take that political message out there, and it's people like you who can help us do that. But it'll be a very active 2 months leading up to Gleneagles. Lastly, on the media, the recommendation here on the media, page 68, for those of you who want to look at it, and I should say that those of you who've got insufficient energy to carry the book home, you can look it up on www.commissionforafrica.org. But on page 68 it says, independent media institutions, public service broadcasters, civil society and the private sector with support from government should form a consortium of partners in Africa and outside to provide funds and expertise to create an African media development facility. that was prompted actually by an African initiative that was brought to our attention. But there is a discussion in Chapter 4 on governance that explains why this is so important. And as Justice Brandeis said, sunshine's a great disinfectant. And if you can get the stories out, you can actually change the reality. And there are lots of quite specific examples on that, which I won't rehearse here.
Okay, well, I just want to take the four last questions, which is that that lady at the back, right? This gentleman here in the yellow, this gentleman up here in the white shirt, and I can't remember who was in order of whatever. Have we got a microphone? So you rehearsed, yeah? Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I have a problem with the essence of the program that you're talking about, because you have said, Mr. Thiem, that it depends. Well, that Africa cannot change, and the change that we're expecting to happen, positive change, cannot be imposed or cannot come from outside. Yet, the same process depends on political will or the charity of the West to really do something about it. In a way, or at the end of the day, it solely depends on that. So my question is, and apart from political will, also the media, and the Western media can also be counterproductive at some points, because it's also very institutionalized, most of it. Like if you go to Italy and Berlusconi media, it won't be necessarily representing the people or the minorities. And also in Africa, the media has played a very negative role, for example, in Rwanda during the genocide, and also in Botswana with the relocation of the Kalahari people. So that is, I think it's relying on something that is not 100% positive, or it's not 100%, it cannot be expected to be positive so much. So my question is, apart from having an economic ambition, which can be doable, like the 7% growth rate, is there a political or social ambition or aim of this project? For example, uniting or making unions with cooperatives in Africa, trade cooperatives, or a political movement, or also joining political movements like trade boycotts in the West and organizations like that, which I know might sound radical, but I think at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if it's radical, because it's about people, so it shouldn't be only about economics.
Thank you. Hi.
My name's Malcolm McIntosh, and I just wanted to carry on Nick's discussion. Very strangely, I found myself in agreement with John Ridwood this morning on the Today programme when he lamented the fact that during the last general election here, climate change, poverty, Africa, sustainable development had hardly been mentioned. And although your report is about political change, governance, capacity building in Africa, surely the same applies to the publics of the G8. Is it possible for you to write a report or to come up with a strategy about educating people in the G8 countries? Because if we get them motivated and moving, then we will get the changes that you're advocating in your report, surely.
Thank you.
Question for Professor Stern. You talked about the first agenda being governance and specific capacity and accountability. It seems to me the most important thing, I haven't read the report yet, so I don't know whether you addressed this, but in terms of capacity, is state capacity and the lack of the ability of African states to tax their own citizens. And that plays, in, of course, into accountability in the sense that you have countries which are heavily aid-reliant, and therefore the accountability actually flows upwards and not downwards, in the sense that they're accountable to Western governments, not to their own citizens. And I don't see how doubling, or you're suggesting now tripling, aid, where Jeffrey Sachs suggests quadrupling aid, is actually going to do anything to improve the situation. I hate to sound like Peter Bauer, but I mean, this is actually quite a serious problem.
All right, okay, and last question here.
Yeah, hello. There seems to be a strong emphasis on Africans being able to solve their own problems, especially coming from Ms. Thiam. And then what I gather from this is that there is, or there should be, a kind of one or two countries emerging as strong leaders on the continent. And these countries should be able to sort of steer the affairs of the continent. And now we have South Africa that has emerged sort of quite clearly, and then it appears Nigeria is also emerging in West Africa. So what has the report, or what has the commission done? Have you recognized these and then try to motivate them, or try to sort of help them in a special way so that they can do that kind of, they can play that kind of role? Thanks.
I'll go briefly first and then to John. Let me take the question about the G8 and say something about taxation. In the election 2 weeks ago, the World Poverty Day fell on a Sunday, and all three parties throughout that Sunday made development the key issue of the day. Now, it was only one day in an election campaign, but it was actually quite a strong day, and both Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, who were commissioners, along with Hilary Benn, the Secretary of State for International Development from the UK government, both of them spoke up very strongly at meetings on that day. And interestingly, the other parties more or less matched what they were saying. And we have committed now to a very sharp increase in the aid budget in the UK. It's already risen pretty rapidly since 1997. But to achieve the 0.7% of GDP by 2013. Now, that is articulated by this current government, but it's been matched, interestingly, by the other parties. So that, I think, is quite encouraging. Would I have liked to have seen more on this in the election campaign? Personally, as a voter, I would. As a servant of Her Majesty, I'm not sure I should speak up too strongly on that. Mm-hmm. But I would like to have seen a much stronger emphasis, but it wasn't lost, and it did have that one day of total focus. I think the educational challenge and the mobilization challenges are really difficult, but I think the Commission for Africa was one part of that story. But the challenge, of course, will be to sustain. I mean, I think we're going to see a crescendo going up to the G8 summit, but what we don't want to do is to lose it after that. But we do need that crescendo if we're to get the commitment, and that commitment is the first thing. I'll just say something on state capacity and taxation. I agree with you very strongly, and so do all the commissioners. Tijan, I know, has strong views on this subject, which I'm sure he'll articulate in just a moment. But on the specifics of what we recommend, we talk a lot about the improvement of governance, and in so doing, lay strong emphasis on taxation as part of that story. And in the package of measures we propose, we argue that of the extra public expenditure that we're advocating, 2/3 should be external and 1/3 should be internal. So we are suggesting quite strong increase in internal revenues. We're being specific about that coming to pass or coming about through the growth rate itself and through a strengthening of governance. But you're quite right that taxation is a key route to accountability, and as someone who's actually tried to raise tax revenues in Africa, we've tried to, as I say, we work for the Treasury, we raise tax revenues here, but Tijan has actually tried to raise and succeeded in raising to some extent tax revenues in Africa, so at this point I'll pass over to him.
Thank you, Nick. We were looking at each other when you were asking the question, because it's something we debated so many times, that it's a familiar topic for us. Just a quick comment on that. One of the problems with taxation is really how it feeds into corruption, because the countries tax what they see, which is what goes through the border, and you have this whole issue of the customs administration. I don't know how many programs we've had in Africa of customs administration reform and so on and so forth, because all the tax, if you take a country like the Ivory Coast, the GDP is $10 billion, the revenues from the land tax were $20 million, I mean 0.2% of GDP, which is absolutely ridiculous, when the cocoa was generating $500 million. So on top of it, it's a disproportionate burden on the agriculture and on the rural poor, who end up paying basically the taxes for the rest of the country. So it's not an issue that's very visible, but I think it's at the heart of really the way some of the African states operate and how bad governance actually has become so pervasive in many countries. So I think the Commission, if you go back to the report, you'll see some quite strong language on that. On the G8, really nothing to add. I think we're in agreement. We need to do much more and be better at educating the public in general and getting the message out there. And I think we're all involved in that, and we must all help. And I think there was a question on South Africa and Nigeria and kind of leading countries. And I think that's part of the vision of the Commission also, that hopefully you can generate some success, but then we'll have positive externalities on the rest of the continent and the region.
Thank you very much. Well, we have to stop there because, as always, we run out of time when we have nice conversations here in the LSE. But I'd just like to thank you all for coming and to urge you to play your part and to lobby others to play their part in accelerating growth for Africa. And will you join me in thanking Nick Stern and Tjaart Tiam?
Copies of the report outside.
Yeah, and these two are available too.